Welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. Today is day two of the YAOL Developer Conference in Brisbane. And with me today, I've got two special guests. We've got Ben Hogan. Hi, Ben.
How are you, Renee?
Where are you working at the moment?
I'm independent.
Independent?
Yes.
So working at all specialty areas around Melbourne?
Yeah, mainly based in Melbourne, doing sort of coaching and sort of a little bit of training. Got a training course in development at the moment in Brisbane and Melbourne. But I've been talking at the conference about my time at REA, realestate.com.au.
DevOps space, is that
That's
correct?
That's right, yeah. Sort of continuous deployment, cloud, Amazon, that kind of thing.
And with me also I've got, is it Pete Moran?
That's me.
And where are you working at the moment, Pete?
I'm at Huru.
And is that based in Sydney, Melbourne?
Huru's in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. We're part of the Qantas Group. So we do the online travel and hotel sites for Jetstar Qantas and for our own site at Huru.com.
And what is Huru.com, you know, if people are unfamiliar with the website, why would they be going there?
Why would they be going to the website?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Well, one reason might be that they've come via either the Jetstar or the Qantas websites themselves. So we provide a branded hotel accommodation search and booking site for those people. So we get a lot of our traffic from people who have booked a flight potentially and then looking for accommodation. Coming to the Huru site, that's really where we're starting to add, I guess, richer features, more socially aware features on top of just the normal search and book experience. So we've only been out there for about 4 months on Huru.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we also provide, I guess, more inspirational content, giving you ideas on why you might want to travel in advance of actually that time when you want to go and book a hotel.
So how many people are at Huru?
The company itself is around about 40.
Oh, wow, that's pretty big.
Yeah. So we've been in existence for about 18 months. We were set up as a startup initially within Jetstar itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were sort of put out onto our own, really when we put the new brand out, which is around about July.
You kicked out, were you?
Not literally. Really, we started out with Jetstar because that was a place in Melbourne for us to be housed.
Mm-hmm.
But the intention was that we're always going to be a standalone company.
Right.
Yeah, within a the Qantas Group itself. So we're effectively now a peer of Jetstar Airways and so on.
So are you a competitor of whatif.com generally?
Yeah, that's right. So I guess we're trying to do things a little bit differently. Obviously, we compete in terms of hotel bookings. But we really want to take it to the next level. We sort of want to be providing a really great experience for people who are looking to travel, as well as that point when they actually purchase hotels. So anyone, I guess, who has booked a hotel know the majority of sites out there are fairly functional. They're very much get a list, get a map, choose one and book. We do that, but we also sort of want to, make it more... the experience, giving you inspirational reasons to actually travel, giving you ideas around it, potentially sharing that out to your network and so on. So it's very much a platform for us to be able to go out and explore new ways of doing online travel.
Excellent. And you're at the conference for a very similar talk, is that correct?
Ben and I are co-hosting. We're co-hosting one of the topics in the DevOps stream. So Ben's been very much talking about how REA have moved from, I guess, a very difficult deployment process and getting that under some sort of control. I've been talking about it from a greenfields point of view. So it's been really interesting for us to sort of get to that realization that, the two companies are very much trying to do the same sorts of things, but coming almost from a completely different background and what some of the different challenges that's thrown up.
So for the listeners, what is DevOps? What is continuous deployment?
So I guess, at REA, we started talking about DevOps a fair bit, and a little while ago we're thinking, oh, is it DevOps a team? But no, for us it's been a change in the culture of a fairly adversarial relationship between developers who break the site and ops people who get paged at midnight. So you've got these angry ops people who think developers just their job is to crash the servers, and you've got developers who think ops people are there to stop them from getting stuff into production. I keep saying no, the department that says no. And for me, DevOps is that kind of the movement to improve the relations between those two roles primarily by just making them communicate more. At REA, what we did is we instituted what we called the DevOps rotation, which was getting a developer to come and sit with ops and getting an ops person to come and sit with a development team.
So co-locate in order for a common understanding?
Exactly. So it's not an uncommon trick, but it's interesting how far apart those worlds might start out, and so it works really well.
So they obviously over time had a greater appreciation of what each other needs and the sort of constraints that they had?
That's right. So that was kind of like a toe in the water. From that, I guess, you know, the sharing of information led to an idea that, well, maybe operations is a permanent part of the job of getting software built. So over time, REA moved from separate operations staff, you know, with this one little rotation thing on the side, to actually moving almost 70% of our ops staff into those delivery teams permanently. So we only have a skeleton infrastructure team left over now. Most of our ops team members work in what they call line of business. And the line of business organisation is the idea that all the different cross-functional roles are organised together. So they sit together, they work together. That's that kind of standard cross-functional kind of model, but applied, you know, across many more roles than is normal.
Were they still acting as DevOps, or did they start to pick up other capabilities and skills? Did they start actually doing development?
In some cases, yeah. So some of the ops guys write code, so that's great. And some of the developers obviously learnt more about operations as a result of this. So it's been a good sort of cross-skilling exercise.
It was quite a journey, as I listened to you talk about it. It was a couple of years ago. It was almost like if you did a day's worth of change, it took 3 months to get through into production, potentially. Very manual, large batch size. What's it at now?
For the Home Ideas team and the new Home Designs websites, they're both able to deploy multiple times a day if they want to. So going from 3 months to 3 hours is a pretty good result, and we're very happy with it.
So what about the original website? Did that similarly get into an area where it's deploying more frequently, or?
It's definitely improved. The flagship website, realestate.com.au, is not one of the ones we're talking about at the moment. So yep. We've got lots of websites, different tabs on the website.
So still a work in progress. Separately.
So the main website is still being chopped up, and the improvements are still coming. I mean, it's a lot bigger problem to attack.
Yeah, because the first thing that came to my mind was, oh, there's a lot of automation there that probably isn't there in that core base that you would have had.
I guess we're attacking, like, there's a lot of systems involved with the flagship website, and as we get more and more systems under this kind of continuous deployment and automation scripting, we'll get more and more of it. But I think the last thing to be continuously deployed will be the main flagship website, realestate.com.au. But we're sort of nibbling around the edges, I think, and we'll be getting there over time.
So what about yourself, Peter?
Well, I guess we were a little bit different in that, look, a big part of it is just the scale. You know, REA, people probably don't really fully understand the scale of what REA actually have to support. And there is just a raw need, I think, to have people who are just continually keeping the site up. And that's I guess, part of the history that REA's been through as their, you know, their volumes and their usages has picked up. We're a little bit different in that when we set out, we always had the one team. So we never actually had that sort of distinction between people who are working on ops and people who are working on development. That being said, we have one guy who is effectively our ops lead, but he's, you know, he joined with the developers, he sits with the developers, they work on different stories, for instance, but we definitely share the load around the things which, you know, we would normally consider, I guess, infrastructure and deployments, as opposed to writing code. So our DevOps guy, Jimmy, he doesn't write, I guess, functional stories, but he writes code in the same repository that we do. So we use Chef as our main deployment tool, our main infrastructure management tool. Those Chef recipes sit side by side with our Ruby code, for instance. So there's constantly that flow of people getting an understanding of how we do deployments, how we manage our infrastructure. But at the same time, he's got like a really fundamental understanding of how the site's architectured and built as well. So I think, you know, just being smaller, it's far easier to share that sort of load around. But it's I think we're doing DevOps in the sense that, you know, pretty much the entire team, you know, we've got 10 developers. They're all responsible for, you know, getting the site deployed, keeping the site up, looking after the infrastructure and so on. And Jimmy acts as the ops lead. I'm working out where that's going to go.
So Ben, you mentioned that you've got a dev team, or you had a dev team in China when you were at REA, is that correct?
Yeah, so the Home Ideas team had only a producer, designer, analyst and iteration manager onshore. The rest of the team was based in the Xi'an province in China, and that was one of REA's sort of offshore teams. And they used a lot of, you know, communication technology to do distributed agile to make that work for them. So
what sort of techniques did you employ? Because I know distributed agile is one of the more difficult things, and almost everyone's still constantly battling with it. Mm. Was it successful, and what do you think made it successful?
Yeah, Mike's team. Yes, Mike's the iteration manager for Home Ideas, and he did a great job of, you know, bridging the culture. So if you've ever read about distributed agile, there's a whole bunch of standard tricks, and they pretty much did all of them and more. So for example, they bought dedicated Skype hardware, cameras and screens, installed them literally in the team's workspace, like at their
so
desks.
So permanent link, yep.
Permanent links, running them 24/7. They did daily stand-up. At one point, the onshore team, all of them, would just fly to Xi'an, and they had a great time. They went out karaoke, they went out drinking. It's like this great kind of culture-building experience of having both teams work together, and that was like the most important thing, to build the trust,
yeah.
To build the face-to-face relationship time. And that cost a lot of money, but it was definitely worth it. So Mike was very good at getting approval to fly people, and we got we had some of the developers from the Home Ideas offshore team come and work with our deployment tools team and work on our deployment tool scripts. So we were donated a developer from that team for a month, and that made that team much more able to take on the tooling that we delivered.
So you mentioned that you shifted to an Amazon server farm. You had one test environment previously, is that correct?
Yeah, we had QA in labs. Labs was broken, so we had one effective testing environment for a growing number of teams. What was interesting is that the teams were getting faster. As they learned about Agile, they started adopting iterations, they started writing code quicker, and that only made it worse, because the faster the developers produced code,
the more they wanted to deploy it.
Yeah, so you can imagine.
Was that intentional? Was there an intent to roll out Agile at the same time as fixing the continuous deployment problem? Or
I think it just became really apparent that once they started fixing their Agile problems, they got very good at Agile. Then, of course, the bottleneck moved downstream to these operations, this poor overworked, you know, operations team that kept getting, you know, code thrown at them. So that's when I joined REA. I was asked to, you know, we seem to have a problem. The problem doesn't seem to be Agile. It's somewhere down there in operations. Go sort that out. Yeah.
So you went from one environment to, in 1 month, something around 112?
In the first 5 months, we went from about 10 servers running in Amazon to over 120.
Then shifted into automated deployment. You talked about AD production environments. What are those?
So we basically used VMware in production, and it allowed us to spin up two complete sets of the production infrastructure very cheaply. So we could have all of our web servers and fast search engine, we could have that running all the time, two copies of it, which meant we could use one copy for deploying staging, and then when we were finished deploying there, we could flip that live. We could serve live traffic from that now active environment, leaving a spare environment for us to do deployments on.
So whose bright idea was that?
I don't remember. Probably our excellent operations team. So we have some pretty pretty knowledgeable guys that know almost everything there is to know about infrastructure and load balances, and a combination of that and some of the ideas we're having about how do we push code out quicker, how do we make it easy to deploy without, you know, running into ourselves.
Okay, so that was the drive, was to be able to deploy without impacting a production environment. Wasn't necessarily a drive towards going towards a lean startup sort of style?
No, so we didn't really come up with AB as a kind of like the AB testing. It wasn't really that. So we weren't sending some people to one stack and other people to the other. It was more inactive and active. So
yeah, so similar to a telephone exchange.
Yeah, for A/B testing, we used Google Analytics at one point, so it would allow us to sort of dynamically insert JavaScript into our website, and that would allow us to do the testing across different versions of.
Okay, so the A/B testing was still built into the code, and you had still an A/B environment for deployment.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, those are two different kinds of A/B. So
what was the setup like at?
Again, a bit different from us. So we use a cloud provider. We use Engine Yard, and we use them from the start. So effectively, our environments are all Engine Yard environments. So it's very easy for us to spin up either clones of an existing environment or build a new one from scratch. But we chose them, you know, in a hurry. I mentioned the talk that we 3 weeks prior to going live, we hadn't actually chosen a cloud provider.
Wow, 3 weeks.
Yeah. So it sort of slipped us by a little bit. It's one of those things that, you know, we were busy doing other things and had this big leap of faith that going into the cloud was going to be easy. And look, we had done some spiking, so we put out some sort of prototypes into Heroku. We had done some work with some of our own managed AWS images and so on. In fact, that was one of the drivers for us to go to a platform as a service approach, is that we actually realised the overhead that was going to be involved in managing your own infrastructure, even on something like EC2. We found that we were building a lot of tooling to automate the process, to get it deployed and so on. It actually started to get a little bit expensive for us, particularly being such a small team. So Engine Yard came recommended to us.
Is that through like a personal relationship?
Yeah, so we know the guys at Redbubble really well, mm-hmm. and they've been Engine Yard users for quite a long time. They don't use quite the platform as a service offering that Engine Yard. Engine Yard have a couple of different offerings, the platform as a service and one more of a managed one. And Redbubble have outgrown the cloud-based solution. They've gone more to the managed solution. But we went with Engine Yard, did a few spikes, realised it was going to work for us. It was very easy for us to tap into their deployment tools and their deployment process as well. So the interesting thing, I think, was that we didn't necessarily expect that to be the last decision we were going to make, but it was a great way for us to get our site out when we needed to. But well over 12 months later, we've been really, really happy with what they've been offering us. So, they've been constantly improving. So they're the offerings that they put on top of Amazon Web Services around their administration panels and so on have, they haven't been without their issues either. Mm. But they turn things over very, very frequently themselves. So, they almost operate in a similar sort of mindset that we do. And we've managed to get the improvements that they've made, stability, reliability, improving the speed of starting up instances, shutting them down and so on. And we've been really happy with them.
So what sort of challenges did you come up with as you went through the journey of continuous deployment and getting people on board and technological challenges? Was it people or technological challenges that you predominantly hit?
Well, I guess we had this experience where we're an established organisation with established policies, like security policies. And one of our challenges were, even being able to get a development team access to the production data centre was a big deal.
For us, I think it was far more people-oriented. The technology around automating our deployments was actually fairly straightforward. So increasing that frequency of deployments from, weeks down to days down to, hours was not a technical challenge necessarily for us. It was more around getting, the whole company buy-in around how this was what we were going to release and how often it was going to happen, because that had a very much a flow-on effect to not only how we do software development, but how we sort of plan out the stories, how we work out, what features are going to be grouped up into any given period
of
time.
So to what level of depth to go to? Is that what you mean?
A little bit that, but also from a planning point of view, when we first started, we took a fairly traditional approach of grouping up a bunch of features into a release. By going into daily releases, you throw that out the window because you're just continually releasing stuff out.
Just release whatever's available, right?
Yeah. So you can obviously still put, artificial milestones on top of that, but we far prefer to be working through, a number of features, in parallel and continually push them out into production. So that had a fairly profound impact on the rest of the organisation. We had to start planning in quite carefully with what marketing campaigns were going on. We have a call centre to handle our customer support requests and so on. We found that we were starting to release new features onto the screens that they used in advance of us telling them about it. So they would, come in on a Monday morning and see new fields appearing on the page, and then obviously they sit next door to us so they can just tap us on the shoulder. But that was a good example where we very much had to get in sync with the other areas of the business to make sure that, they fully understood how frequently we wanted to release. And we sort of, made sure that what we were releasing was in line with what the rest of the company was doing.
So what about innovation? Does innovation play a part in any of this? Is it an enabler for more innovative products, do you think?
Yeah, I guess one of the unexpected benefits of being able to deploy automatically for us was this kind of positive feedback cycle that happened. You know, I write a bit of code, I deploy it into production, and now I can see, get some feedback from the end users. And this kind of inspired a lot of creativity in the Home Ideas team. They found themselves coming up with new ideas, and the more they deployed ideas into production, the more new ideas they had. And it became a very addictive, very positive reinforcing loop.
Was it something that you had to rein developers in eventually, or...?
Yeah, it's not just the developers, but the whole team, the producers and the iteration managers, they were getting pretty excited. At some point, Mike said, you know what, we should just slow down. We can't be deploying every day. We'll just get exhausted. So, that's kind of... they did pull back a little bit occasionally.
And what about it for yourself?
Innovation. Look, I think it has. I think we've sort of tried to get that sort of feedback loop going as well. We don't get an awful lot of feedback from our customers, which we want to do a lot more of. So it's quite hard for us to gauge whether or not the things that we're putting out and testing. So we're starting to use obviously a lot more metrics around that. So A/B testing has become an important aspect for us, where we can put out. We started very light touch on that around changing some of the messaging around some of our pages. So that's been important for us to start getting the mechanisms in place to be able to say, well, if you put out two lots of messaging, work out which one customers are responding to and what that actually means. Because it's all very well to get this data, you've then got to work out how to interpret it and work out which ones actually are converting better. But I think we're getting better at it, and we work quite closely with an SEM, search engine marketing company, who are giving us some really good advice on how to test the market and put things out and see how customers are responding to that as well.
So in both of your presentations, you had quotes that were very similar that related to the fact that if you are deploying very frequently, very continuously, you can get something out to production. If it fails, you'll know about it pretty much straight away, and it won't take a lot of effort to fix it up. It'd be a very short period of time to fix it. Does that mean the role of a tester is dead?
It's changed. It's definitely changed for us, it's changed in a big way. And I think the people, when we went to daily releases, the people who were most liberated were our testers. And part of that was because they were starting to feel the stress, the workload stress of being that gatekeeper before things actually got released into production, because it means that they were getting big long lists of cards stacked up that they would look at and say, I have to get through all of these cards in order for something to go out into production. And it got us to talking very hard around, well, what does testing actually mean for us? We've got this idea, which we haven't got to yet, that we should just be able to trust the green light. So the green light is the light that goes green when our full set of continuous integration tests go green. We're not at that point, and part of that is because a number of reasons. One is we like doing the sort of exploratory testing that test automation is difficult to achieve. Mm-hmm. And partly because we do a fair bit of integration with third parties where we can't actually automate things like setting up the data that we want and then tearing it down and repeating it. So we're actually forced to do some manual testing, which means that we might go off into an external system and set up a hotel and see what search results we get back based on different locations and so on. But the liberating thing for the testers, for us, when we went to daily releases, is that they're not reliant on... we don't stop going to production if they haven't got to do all the testing they hope to do.
Okay.
So that role of tester has very much changed, where they're no longer sort of that gatekeeper having to do like a full big regression test over the entire suite. Is that they're working out of band of what the actual developers are actually pushing into production to provide sort of like this QA level on top of what we might already have pushed into production.
I guess your testing changed for us as well. Like the change in testing was this idea that we don't have to test everything to death. Don't need that 120% test coverage.
It doesn't have to be done.
Yeah, and being willing to release things that were less tested made it possible for them to go a lot quicker.
Does that mean that you needed to establish a cultural environment of being safe to fail? Like when the first issue started happening in production, did the culture enable that to be okay?
Well, Pete's quote's good for this one, or Kent Beck actually, who said, as long as it's not broken for too long, it looks like unbroken success. And that's, I guess, for Mike, who was managing the stakeholders. A lot of the times they wouldn't even know that there'd been a small, blip.
Hiccup, yep.
Yeah.
I remember when we had one of our first, I guess, what we'd call, serious issues come up in production. And we went and we told our executive manager, that there's this issue. It's quite an important one. And, start to see the blood pressure rise and all these sorts of things. And his question was, well, when on earth are you going to get that fixed? And our response was, well, it could be tomorrow, but if we think it's serious enough, then we'll do it, another push, a release out today. And instantly, the pressure valve was just released. And it was an eye-opener, I think, for all of us, is that having that frequency of releasing and being prepared to do it when things do go wrong, the problems, they don't go away, but they just make it, almost insignificant that, the
cost to the business is so small.
Yeah, because I'm expecting he was expecting to get some sort of answers, we'll have to put a couple of developers on for a couple of days and it's going to be a week, because that's typically what people are used to hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very liberating, I think, for all of us to get that realisation that things can be, not quite okay for a short period of time, as long as you can quickly iterate on it and get it fixed, In sort of days, and then you're pretty much good to go.
Excellent. So if the listeners have any questions that they want to talk to you about, what's the best way that they can contact you?
So agileben.com has the written version of the talk, which is a good read. So download that. It's available now. It's a PDF. It's got more than the talk does. You can watch the talk, obviously, when it goes up on the YAL site. Or Twitter, agileben, for me.
I'm Peter Moran on Twitter, otherwise peter@huru.com will get through to me.
Great, well thank you both very much for coming on to the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you.